This is Embodied on the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. When was the last time a friend gave you a really good hug or a pat on the shoulder, a warm handshake? These kinds of once normal daily gestures are not part of our new reality. With shelter-at-home orders still in place, our opportunities for physical contact are more limited, and this has altered our relationship with one of our primary senses, touch. How has this time of more physical distancing and less touch shaped our mental and physical well-being? Two touch experts are with me today. Tiffany Field is the director of the Touch Research Institute at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. Tiffany, welcome.
Thank you.
Also here is Paula Scataloni, a licensed clinical social worker and somatic experiencing practitioner. She's also a certified eating disorder specialist and the co-owner of the Embodied Recovery Institute in Chapel Hill. Hi, Paula.
Hi, thank you.
And we would love to hear from all of you on Twitter. Have you been missing physical touch, or have you found other ways to feel physical connection? Join the conversation now using the hashtag #EmbodiedWUNC. So, Paula, I'd love to start with you as someone who thinks a lot about the mind-body connection and really how we hold stress in our bodies. Can you explain what kind of impact you think this crisis is having on our physical body? What's going on?
Sure. So what I see is the COVID pandemic is causing many of us to cycle through the threat response. And this is a system that is designed to protect us from threat. So briefly, we have a hierarchy of responses that are built into our autonomic nervous system. And under threat, the first system of response is our social engagement system. So we tend to turn to other humans for protection. And obviously, you know, we don't have access to that right now. But if that system is not available to reduce the perceived threat, then we start to go into our next line of defense, which is our sympathetic nervous system. And this is a system that governs our mobilization response, such as fight or flight. And when this system gets activated, we start to have a release of chemicals like adrenaline that support our fight or flight. And we're going to feel things like increased heart rate, muscle tension. We're going to scan the environment for danger. And emotionally, we're going to start to feel things like anger or anxiousness, maybe have panic attacks, racing thoughts, difficulty sleeping, trouble focusing, or even paranoia.
Interesting. So touch when it is safe and wanted, that moves us away from that fight or flight and more into that kind of parasympathetic self-regulation mode.
Yes, it's part of our social engagement system, which I can explain if you want to know about that.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll come back to that as we talk about kind of ways to access these kinds of things when we're not touching each other as much. But Tiffany, I want to give you a chance to join the conversation now. I know you've been studying touch for a really long time. Do you think that people are touch deprived right now? What's your take on this moment of touch?
Well, I think that in public, we are, of course, keeping our social distance, and we don't even have elbow bumping anymore, which we started out having. So that, in a sense, is very, very different. Although we had been studying touch and social interaction at airport gates over the last year, and 98% of the time people were on their cell phones.
Okay.
So there wasn't much touch going on in public.
Interesting. Okay.
So I don't think that there's so much touch deprivation out in public situations. But there certainly is for single people who are at home. I'm hoping that for couples and for families, there's even more touch with hugging and back rubs and all those things to calm everybody down. I think the reference to the parasympathetic system is very critical, because what we find is that when people are receiving touch, the vagal activity increases and the stress hormones are reduced, such as cortisol. And that saves natural killer cells. Natural killer cells kill viral cells. So at a time when we really need our immune system to be functioning at a good pace, we're seeing that people are not being touched, and therefore it's a challenge to their immune system.
Well, I want you to break that down a little bit, because you just said a lot there that's really interesting. So
what happens is when you move the skin, you're stimulating pressure receptors under the skin, and the stimulus goes to the vagus. The vagus in turn knocks down cortisol, which is our primary culprit stress hormone, and that saves natural killer cells. And natural killer cells not only ward off viral cells, but also bacterial and cancer cells. So it's a very lawful physiological, biochemical, bioelectrical kind of response. And what we've found is that things like massage and yoga are quite equivalent in getting that kind of response. So I'm recommending that people who are alone engage in either yoga programs that are online on Zoom, or do a lot of stretching, do crunchies, do sit-ups, walk around the room. If you're just walking around the room, you're stimulating pressure receptors in your feet, which helps the whole system. Our hand washing is stimulating our hands a great deal. So there are lots of ways to compensate for the absence of touch in terms of people who are alone.
And our natural killer cells, you're talking about white blood cells?
No, they're different. They're immune cells that are at the front line of the immune system, and they have a special role of knocking down viral, bacterial, and cancer cells.
Oh, interesting. Wow. So, okay, so touch is good for our immune system. It is good for so many things we're going to continue to talk about. One of those things is relationships and bonding. And I want to play a clip from one of our listeners named Stormy, a listener in Cary, who is in the midst of starting a new relationship and is kind of reflecting on what that's looking like without a lot of touch and contact. Let's listen.
I have lived alone for 25 years, and I've been single for most of my adult life. And there, you know, in the before time, there were periods of over a week or more that I would go without touching people. And now that I can't, it's almost physically painful, you know, not to be able to hug someone or even shake a hand. I recently started dating someone just before all this happened, and not being able to see him or touch him is really painful. It's almost like an amputee with, you know, phantom limb syndrome. You know, you ache for something that's not there anymore. I do worry about how this enforced physical distance and isolation is going to affect my new relationship. It's really hard to keep up a spark if you just can't be in each other's presence.
So that's Stormy calling in from Cary. I am here with Paula Scatoloni, a social worker and somatic experiencing practitioner, as well as Tiffany Field, the director of the Touch Research Institute at the University of Miami. So Paula, tell me about what you hear in Stormy's clip and the role of touch in connection and bonding.
Mm-hmm. So I'm hearing her reference what I mentioned earlier, which is our social engagement system, right? So this is our system of communication and connection and how we communicate safety in relationship and how we bond. And so since touch is one of the parts of that system and that's not available, then we're being asked to utilize other aspects of that system to feel a sense of connection, like eye contact and facial expression and intonation of voice. And those may not be things that we're used to really tuning into to feel someone's presence. And so I hear that, and I hear how regulating touch is and this recognition around that, especially when it's not available. And so we're having to get very creative around what options do we have when that particular type of regulation, which I call part of co-regulation, interactive regulation, is not an option.
When it comes to touch, I mean, do you feel like there are some kinds of touch that are more important than others? Like, is there a hierarchy in terms of the effect on our bodies, like kind of a full frontal hug and then next step, like a side hug? Or how does that work?
Yeah. Personally, just from my practice perspective, I think it's very subjective. Hmm. I mean, our first question is, what is the history of safe touch in a person's life, right? And is it a resource? And if it was, then they may have a preference as in where we want to be touched or where it's more regulating. We do know from research that if couples hold a full body hug for several minutes, it triggers and brings them both into a more parasympathetic state. Hmm. So, you know, there may be angles where that's more, you know, there's more of a tendency for that to happen with the full frontal hug. But I tend to think of touch as subjective, and we all have different preferences. Right?
Yeah. And obviously, I mean, there are some kinds of touch that are not positive and not all touch is good.
Yeah.
And we're actually going to be talking more about this next week, looking at how stay-at-home orders have increased incidents of domestic violence. So there's that whole side of the conversation as well that we'll be touching on later. But Tiffany, I wonder for you, I mean, in terms of the different types of touch receptors that we have in our bodies, walk me through the science of that and how we can try to activate all of those various kinds of touch receptors right now in this moment when maybe we don't have people to kind of give us a head rub and then give us a foot rub and give us a back massage.
Well, all of that, if we don't have it available from someone else, we have to do to ourselves, for ourselves. You can basically rub any part of your body. And if you feel awkward doing that with your hands, you can use a ball. Whenever we stretch on the floor, we're basically stimulating all the pressure receptors, which is what's key to getting vagal activity increase and getting that whole chain of events that I was speaking to. So I think people have to really focus on making sure they get enough of that, and particularly getting some of that before bedtime, because we know now that stimulating the pressure receptors before bedtime does facilitate sleep. And one of the biggest problems happening during this COVID-19 is people are getting sleep deprived. When you're sleep deprived or you don't get enough deep sleep, substance P, with a capital P, is emitted, and that causes pain. So people will be developing pain syndromes if they're not getting enough sleep. And to get enough sleep, they need to make sure that they're spending some time moving their skin. Of course, it's better to have someone else doing that for you, because there's an emotional, social, as we were just hearing, there's a very strong social component. But if you don't have that, and the person that you were recording, I think, you know, perhaps we'll have to find other ways to communicate via Zoom, via doing social distancing on walking with her new boyfriend. There are going to have to be ways to compensate for not being able to touch each other during these times.
We have another clip to play now of a creative suggestion or ways that people are seeking out feelings of connectedness. This is from a massage therapist in Durham named John Williford.
For everyday people, just touching each other more, touching our kids more, and our spouses more can be really helpful regarding regulating the hormone response. And so decreasing the adrenaline response and increasing things like endorphins and dopamine, things, you know, the hormones that make us feel good. We've been working with our clients who are pregnant and are having, you know, mid back pain and low back pain. And we've been working on techniques that anyone can do, such as a husband or spouse or whoever can work with them. They just have to know what to do, what to think about, and what questions to ask the receiver. And so over time, that will hopefully help relieve, you know, their stressors so that they can enjoy one another's company as well as just living better lives. And if people are alone, like say if they're able to work with plants, so grooming, like weeding, cutting away dead parts of plants, also gives us that same effect, as well as being outside.
So that's John Williford, a massage therapist and the co-owner of the Tranquility Company in Durham. I'm here with Paula Scataloni, a social worker and somatic experiencing practitioner, as well as Tiffany Field, the director of the Touch Research Institute at the University of Miami. So Paula, John mentioned some massage techniques. We had Tiffany kind of talking about using a tennis ball. Do you have other ways, kind of based on your therapeutic experience, that you recommend people induce feelings of touch? And maybe you can explain kind of this, the science behind any of the ones that you suggest.
Mm-hmm. So in somatic experiencing, we support clients in utilizing self-touch a lot. And there is a regulatory component when we touch ourselves similar to another person. And then there's also that, what we call proprioceptive contact that's happening, where the body, the part that's being touched, is having an experience, right, of being seen and heard. And so in our practice, we might teach clients to put one hand on their head and one on their chest, or a hand on the heart and a hand on the stomach, and just breathe into those places. And, you know, maybe your heart is racing or your gut is feeling uneasy. And the longer you stay with it and witness with mindfulness, the calmer things should start to become. Other types of tools I might use are things like a weighted lap pad or a weighted blanket, things that occupational therapists would use to calm children that are dysregulated, or have, they'll use it for babies in the NICU, will be swaddled with a weighted blanket. And this really soothes the nervous system. And if people don't have money for a weighted blanket, because they can be expensive, I'll have clients go buy a 5-pound bag of rice and put that on their lap. That can help as well.
Yeah. I mean, it makes me wonder, I guess, how does our body, there's obviously kind of the factual information that our body receives about, you know, there is a weight on me, there is a pressure on me, but then there's emotional information too. I mean, I think about kind of, you know, a handshake or a hug with someone you don't know very well as compared to a hug with your best friend. Like it feels different. There's an emotional and a sensory part of the experience of touch. So how, Tiffany, can you explain how that works, kind of how our body brings in the factual as well as the emotional and puts that together to give us, you know, information about what this touch means?
Well, I think, you know, there's a book called 365 Hugs. You mentioned hugging and how it's different with different people. With most of our acquaintances, we do the A-frame hug, where we're just, our arms are around the shoulder, whereas with a significant other, we do a full body hug. And there are, of course, huge differences between those, not just socially and emotionally, but when you're doing a firm hug with a significant other, all parts of your body are being stimulated, as opposed to the A-frame, where you maybe get a little bit on your shoulders and maybe they're slapping you on the back, so you get a little bit on the back. So a lot of it has to do with what body parts are being stimulated. We have different representation on the brain of different parts of the body, with some parts being greater. For example, the face and the hands have more representation in the brain. And so a lot of people are commenting, for example, that they don't like wearing masks because their face starts itching. The stimulation from the mask is itching their face. And they don't like washing their hands so much because it kind of makes them feel like they're overstimulating themselves. So it's a very complicated phenomenon. There's some research out that shows that we can communicate different emotions by the way we touch. We might push someone when we're angry or disgusted. We might pat someone on the back or stroke the back when we're being sympathetic. We don't use touch as very often as a means of communication, because we do have many touch taboos. The children are not supposed to be touched by teachers in the public school system, et cetera. So it's hard to know, and it's hard to know what's going to happen when this is over. Are we going to stay with elbow bumping? Are hugs going to come back? I doubt it for a while, especially with the second wave that's being predicted.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people are fearful.
We're going to take a quick pause here, and we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about how this may change things moving forward. Interested to hear both of y'all's thoughts on that. We'll continue this conversation just ahead, learning about touch, and we'll also look at animal shelters and pets and how they can play a role in all of this. Please stay with us just ahead. This is Embodied on the State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. Touch plays a big role in how we relate to people around us, whether that's through hand-holding, hugging, or even high-fiving. But our new social distancing restrictions have changed when and how we touch one another. We're continuing our conversation on the relationship between touch and our physical and mental well-being. Still with me is Tiffany Field, the director of the Touch Research Institute at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine, and Paula Scataloni, a licensed clinical social worker and somatic experiencing practitioner. She's also a certified eating disorder specialist and the co-owner of the Embodied Recovery Institute in Chapel Hill. We'd also love for you to join the conversation on Twitter. Have you been missing physical touch? Have you found other ways to feel physical contact? We heard from Andrew, who says, as a person who has touch as a love language, I'm so thankful to have my wife at this time. Even with that, I miss my friends so much. Do you relate to Andrew's story? Share yours with us using the hashtag #EmbodiedWUNC. I'd like to start off with a clip about someone who feels a little bit differently about touch during this time of lockdown. So let's listen to Jean from Raleigh.
I get emails like every other day, text messages, like, you know, if I could, I would hug you. And that's just not something I see every day on a normal, you know, non-COVID quarantine time. They don't say, I miss being touched. I miss, because it's not just, I miss having my massage every week. It's not a pampering.
So that was Blake Moriarty, who's a massage therapist in Durham. She's actually talking about how her clients are expressing a new desire to give her physical affection. That is one perspective. We are going to hear now about Jean, and then I'm going to come back and talk with Paula and Tiffany. So this is Jean from Raleigh, who is feeling some relief about not having to deal with awkward hugs from coworkers.
My name is Jean. I'm calling from Raleigh. I am relieved not to be around people right now, in part because of the pandemic, but also I think I don't like to hug my coworkers, and they seem to be a hugging bunch of people, and so that kind of puts me at odds when they want to hug me and I don't want to hug them back. So it's frankly a relief not to have to deal with those items.
So that's Jean calling in from Raleigh. I'm here with Paula Scataloni, a social worker, and Tiffany Field, the director of the Touch Research Institute at the University of Miami. So two very different perspectives there. Blake, who's saying she's hearing from people who want to give her a hug, who she hadn't heard wanted to give her a hug before. And then Jean saying she's a little relieved at not having to hug her coworkers, but is a little concerned about what these new rules will mean for touch going forward. Paula, tell me about this question of fear. And you know, do you think that that is going to take some time to dissipate? I know for me, you know, when I'm watching a TV show now and I see people very freely touching each other, I almost have this visceral reaction of fear and concern because I know, you know, you're not supposed to do that right now. So how, you know, what do you think, how long is this going to live with us?
Well, I think it's all going to depend on how long the quarantine lasts and what a relationship to touch was prior to, right? If we had positive relationship with it, and what world we come into after COVID. You know, is it going to be a world where, you know, we feel safe, or even though COVID's over, if our community, our governments, our world doesn't help to solicit feelings of safety, we're going to stay in states of threat.
Tiffany, even I know when, go ahead.
It's over. Oh, even though the threat itself might be over.
Right.
So those factors would, prevent us from relaxing.
Tiffany, I know that you are doing some research right now, trying to learn some lessons about touch in this time. What are you curious about? I mean, what lessons do you think that we may learn from this moment?
Well, I think that we're probably going to learn that people who are continuing to exercise and people who are in close proximity where they can be touching their significant other are probably going to be less depressed and less anxious and maybe have less PTSD than those of us who are alone and who are at high risk for various reasons. Those folks, I expect, are going to continue to be very careful, to maybe just elbow bump, keep their social distance. Some people may even continue wearing masks and, you know, will begin to look like the Japanese who wear masks all the time, it seems. So I think that, like Paula was saying, you know, people have individual differences about how how close they are. I see a lot of people who aren't paying any attention to social distancing, and then a lot of other people who are. And so I think that these individual differences will continue.
And I guess it could be an interesting moment to kind of think about our own individual relationships with touch and which things kind of deregulate us or activate us. I mean, I know, Paula, I have some friends who don't make a lot of eye contact when you talk to them, but they actually really don't mind hugging. So there are kind of all of these different ways that our sensory systems are wired slightly differently. And this may be a moment to be able to reflect a little bit more on that now that we have this kind of forced period of not touching one another. Do you think?
Exactly. I think we're going to start to pay attention to those other subtler systems that are more nuanced and experience them as resources or get curious about, you know, what does regulate us. And, you know, we may find that touch is definitely something that regulates and we missed. And we may find that some of those other systems actually regulate us more.
We don't have a lot of time left, but I know that Anthony Fauci said at one point, you know, we may never handshake again. Maybe we shouldn't ever handshake again. And it makes me think a lot about kind of these customs, these social customs, and how they are in the U.S. as compared to other places around the world. I know, Tiffany, you've researched kind of touch here in the U.S. as compared to other places. Could you kind of talk briefly about that and how you think, I mean, this may play out differently in the U.S. versus other places where they are touching each other so much more pre-pandemic times?
Right. Well, certainly what we've done many studies in Paris versus Miami and places like playgrounds and McDonald's restaurants, and they're much more touchy-feely than we are. I think they're probably feeling much more touch-deprived than we are. So, yes, there are significant differences around the world. And that's one of the things we're trying to tap in our survey, and if anyone wants to do the survey, it's surveymonkey.com/r/COVID-19-study. So you can go on Facebook and get that link, or you can take the link I just gave you at SurveyMonkey. And I think the data will be really interesting in terms of telling us what are the effects of our touch deprivation and our social distancing.
Wonderful. We'll put a link to that on our website and share it on Twitter as well. Tiffany Field is the director of the Touch Research Institute at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. Paula Scatoloni, a licensed clinical social worker and somatic experiencing practitioner, also a certified eating disorder specialist and co-owner of the Embodied Recovery Institute in Chapel Hill. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was very interesting.
Thank you. We enjoyed it.
So those craving companionship in addition to touch are also turning to some other things like animal shelters and pet fostering to meet their new needs. With me now to discuss the ins and outs of that process is Joanne Duda. She's a foster coordinator and acting rescue coordinator for the Wake County Animal Center. Joanne, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And we also want to hear from you on Twitter. Have you tried to foster or adopt a pet during the pandemic? Is that changing your experience of touch or living alone? Let us know with the hashtag #EmbodiedWUNC. So we've been talking a lot about kind of touch and its importance for our physiological selves, our emotional selves. You spend a lot of time with animals. I'm wondering how do you feel like animals fit into this conversation about touch and happiness?
So the funny thing about animals is they're unconditional love. You know?
Yes.
They're never going to say, I hate you, Mom. You know, they are so happy. Well, except for cats. Sometimes, you know, cats. But, you know, when you walk into a dog, you're their world. And they are so happy to see you. And, like, everything is wonderful. Or, you know, if you're more of a quiet kind of chill kind of person, sometimes there's just nothing better than laying down with a cat on your stomach, just, you know, purring away. It's just very calming. So pets are wonderful for stuff like that.
I mean, and it seems like people know that because there's been reporting about this uptick in people kind of wanting to foster or wanting to adopt. Is that something that you have seen in Wake County? Is that something you're noticing, a similar trend?
It 100% is. My applications have gone through the roof. Unfortunately, I'm not able to take advantage of that as much right now due to all of the restrictions. But our rescue partners have also seen a huge uptick in in the application process. They're still adopting animals out. We're still adopting animals out. We were wondering if, because of the restrictions and we've gone to appointment only, if that would actually slow things down. It hasn't.
It hasn't.
It's worked out for days for people making appointments to come meet animals.
Is that surprising you that there's such a surge in interest right now?
I mean, it really is because there's obviously financial concerns, you know, because some people are like, you know, do we want to adopt out to people who may be financially unstable right now or maybe soon? But the fact of the matter is that a lot of people are embracing what you've been talking about, the lack of contact.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an easy way to have contact with another living thing that can respond to you, you know, without having to worry about the spread of COVID.
Do you think, this is a question I've been wondering a lot. I am the owner of a dog, but I'm wondering whether pets are perceiving any of our stress in this time. I mean, what do you think about that? Like, do they have a narrative in their head about what's going on and the fact that all these people are now at home so much more often?
So I don't know if they think much about that. Like, most animals live in the now.
Uh-huh.
But they are very perceptive. And I don't know if you've grown up around animals. I always have. I have three dogs right now. They know when something's up. Like, if I'm not feeling well, guess what? I've got dogs around me. You know, they're like, are you okay, Mom? Can I just lay on your lap right now, Mom? You know, so they know. Animals are very perceptive. They pick up on biorhythms. They pick up on, you know, the vibes that you give off. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of validity to that.
So if people are hearing this and are feeling really excited about the idea of fostering or adopting, do you have any kind of guidance for what they should consider before they march to your office? And maybe you could eliminate the difference between fostering and adopting. Those are two pretty different things.
Yeah, there is a huge difference there. I mean, fostering is helping animals or humans as well, but get them over a little hump that they may have and get them to a position where they are available and actually adopting them out. Whereas if you're looking to bring in a pet and adopt, then, you know, you want to take on that responsibility on a permanent basis. And that's something that with what we're going through right now, I don't know if everybody considers the fact that life will go back to somewhat normal eventually. And, you know, you'll go back to work, you'll go back to the office, the kids will go back to school or daycare or whatever, and this pet who you've just brought in, and it's been glorious, you know, has been used to all this stuff, and there may be some behavioral, you know, ramifications because now they're not getting all that attention that they did before when they were first brought in. So there's a lot of things to consider. Adopting an animal is a commitment for the life of that animal. And so that is something that before you make that leap, please do think about the fact that this is not real right now.
Yeah.
This is a microcosm, if you will. And, you know, real will be coming back. And is this something that you can maintain when your life comes back, when you're actually able to go out and interact with people again, you know, when you have more work obligations or social obligations that will take you back out of the house?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's definitely something that people need to take into consideration and not think in the short term.
There are also some interesting, I mean, I've been reading some interesting reporting around, you know, the experience of people who go to the hospital and have to leave their pets at home or people, you know, who pass away. So there might be a chance that there is a surge in pets coming back to shelters after all of this. I guess either people realizing that they can't take care of them or their life circumstances have changed so drastically, loss of job, that kind of thing. Are you all preparing for any kind of surge in pets coming back? Is that something on your radar?
I mean, it's always on our radar. It's probably just a larger scale of, say, Christmas or summer vacation, because we see surges in adoptions at those times as well. So is it on our radar? Sure. Is there a real way to prepare for it? Not really. Not as far as we're concerned. I mean, maybe we can bring in more foster parents, but, you know, we're a physical building, so we can only hold so much in the physical building, and we deal with everything that comes in. So, yeah, it's something that we are discussing, just as we were discussing prior to the shutdown. You know, what are we going to do once that stay-at-home order comes? So, yeah, we are thinking about it.
I only have about 30 seconds left, but do you have any advice for pet owners of kind of little self-regulating, de-stressing activities they can do with their pet? I know obviously taking a dog on a walk, but are there any kind of bonding exercises or anything like that?
It's, you know, just like people are individuals, animals are as well. You know, if there are cuddly animals and then there's more aloof type animals, but know your pet and know what their triggers are, their positive triggers are. If they like to cuddle with you, then a wonderful bonding thing is literally Netflix and a chill. You know, that it sounds silly, but there's truth to it. But if they're more of an active animal, then yeah, find yourself a baseball field that's fenced in and throw a ball. Or if you're a cat person or a little critter person, you know, get that toy out and set them up and just, you know, play with them and engage them and get that energy out and, you know, bond with them that way. Absolutely.
Joanne Duda is the foster coordinator and acting rescue coordinator at the Wake County Animal Center. Joanne, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can find out more about everyone we talked about today at our website, stateofthings.org. For the next episode of Embodied, we would love to hear more of your stories. And we want to know about how the fight against COVID-19 has influenced choices, rituals, and maybe your own relationship with death. Have you attended a virtual funeral? Do you have a loved one in palliative care? Do you have any story or experience about death or dying that you'd like to share with us? We would love to hear your story. Call or text us, 919-980-5419. That's 919-980-5419. That's The State of Things for today, a program produced by Amanda Magnus, Grant Hollab-Mormon, Kaya Finlay, Stacia Brown, and Jennifer Brookland. Josie Taras is our intern. Jenny Lawson is our technical director. Al Wodarski also helped engineer today's show. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.